Truth and Transcendence. Brought to you by Yes, You Now, with Catherine Llewellyn. Truth and Transcendence, episode 47, with special guest Madeline Black. Now, for those who haven't come across Madeline, Madeline Black is an author, a speaker, a sexual violence activist, a psychotherapist, and a podcaster. Although I understand she doesn't do the psychotherapy work at the moment, but perhaps we'll talk more as we go through the episode about what Madeline is doing now. Tragically, at the age of 13, Madeline was raped and tortured by two men. She chose to forgive them and found a way to move on. In 2014, after decades of silence, Madeline decided to speak out. The sharing of her story publicly on the Forgiveness Project's website in 2014 opened many doors. Madeline was approached by numerous women and men thanking her and saying that reading her story gave them strength, hope, and a different perspective of what's possible in their lives. She has shared her story on TV, radio, and at conferences, book events, schools, and more. In 2017, she published her brilliant memoir, Unbroken. In 2018, Madeline won the Amazing Strength Award at the number one magazine, Amazing Women Awards. And later that year was asked to be the patron for Say Women, a Scottish organisation which offers safe accommodation and support to young women who are survivors of sexual abuse, rape, and who are homeless. She is one of 50 Thrivers, with a capital T, taking part in research by the Global Resilience Project to develop a resilience blueprint for others. She is a 2-times TEDx speaker, a storyteller for the Forgiveness Project, and has recently become involved with their program Restore, sharing her story in prisons. In 2020, Madeline was asked to be patron for Justice Is Now, an organization that campaigns to end the use of rape myths and victim blaming in the criminal justice system. Later that year, she launched her podcast, Unbroken, Healing Through Storytelling, and became an ambassador for freedom from abuse. So I think you can guess why I wanted to invite Madeline. I mean, her extraordinary work in the area of trauma and shame, helping the wounded speak out and reclaim their sovereignty and their sense of self and their personal power. I am personally inspired by Madeline's courage, her generosity of spirit, and her dedication to her wonderful work. We all hold shame and trauma to one degree or another, and so do our people. We can all learn from Madeline's experience and perspective. So Madeline's a very busy lady, so I'm very grateful, Madeline, that you were able to find the time to come and join us. Thank you so much for coming on to Truth and Transcendence.
You're very welcome, Catherine. Thanks for inviting me.
So I think it's no surprise that we're continuing our theme of speaking out with Madeline as a guest today, because Madeline's actually been working with the notion of speaking out, maybe not calling it that, for quite some time. So, Madeline, can you remember when you first had the thought or connected with the notion that speaking out was an important thing to do or something you felt drawn to doing?
Yes, I always did speak out, but I did it kind of anonymously. So if ever you read any of these articles and papers and you saw Madeline, 50, London, and then there was one of these blacked out silhouettes, all normally with your face to the side for some reason. I did that a little while, but I do remember the exact moment. So the Forgiveness Project normally have events that take place in London, and I'm based in Glasgow. Mm. And our founder, Marina Cantacuzuno, told me that there was an event in a school called Shorelands Academy. Is that near to me? It's literally like 2 minutes up the road from where I live. So I went along to this event. It was a woman called Marion Partington, whose sister Lucy was raped and murdered by the serial killers Rosa and Fred West. But when I heard her speak, she just really emanated peace. She was amazing and she's shared her story many, many years in prisons doing restore work as well and in different conferences at schools. This was at a school, it's like a multi-faith thing. And I bought her book, which is a beautiful book. It was called If You Sit Very Still. And inside she had written, Now You Must Speak. And up until that moment, I thought, I don't know, you know. But when I saw that, I thought, you know, I think I could. I think I could share my story because I saw, you know, the impact of her words, where they landed on people and what it, the impact that had. And I just think, well, courage is contagious. I thought, you know, if she can do that, then I could share my story. And that also kind of unleashed my writing as well, because I thought, I'm just going to write my story down for myself. And literally that night, I just started to see all of my words. They all kind of came to me. And about 8 weeks later, I'd written them about 70,000 words. So I really say Marion kind of was my catalyst for finding my voice. It was an idea that was already in there, but she kind of cemented it, I suppose.
Amazing. So her example sounds like that was incredibly inspiring.
Yeah, absolutely.
And encouraging. But yeah. you must have somehow on some level been almost ready.
Yeah, because it was just after that, the fact when I had shared my story publicly with the Forgiveness Project, so that was September 2014, and this was about the November, and Marina put together a book, Stories for a Vengeful Age, for the Forgiveness Project, and they were 50 of the stories from the Forgiveness Project's website. She collects stories of people that are able to forgive or choose to forgive. And I'm just one of many, many hundreds of her stories. And the publishers asked me, after sharing my story publicly, if I would be included in that book. So I had, you know, shared my story on the website, which went a bit viral. Then I was in a book. And so that was, I had already exposed myself, I guess. So I was a bit used to doing that. And then when Marion, hearing her speak and what she'd written in her book to me, it just thought, okay, this is maybe now my next step. So I've always just tried to now trust life and just let it take me wherever it's going. So I just trusted the process that this is what was meant to do. And writing my book, I just felt so supported. Something came in from somewhere. I don't know who it was, but it felt like somebody was just behind my back the whole time saying, right, right, right. And I was like the dancing shoes, but with my hands, it was just felt like automatic writing in some way.
Yeah, beautiful. So it sounds like you were really going with the energy of the direction that was being offered you. It sounds like you were responding to an invitation almost.
Yeah, it didn't really feel like I had a choice.
Yeah,
kind of took over me in the writing. It was like this mad woman just writing every day. But yeah, something took hold of me without a doubt. Something supported me in the process, and yeah, I just went with it.
Yeah, you had that incredible feeling of being supported and protected when you were doing the writing, and you also had that feeling of responding to something almost as if you had no choice. So you were almost swept along in something. Was all of that a very new experience for you, or had elements of that been present for you in your life prior to that?
That was the first time with writing that I had ever really felt that. I'd never, ever thought that I could ever let anyone hear or read what had happened to me. You know, that idea years ago would have just been too much for my shame. It would have just said to be so ridiculous. But I can remember I went to see a medium when I was struggling to accept my memories that returned. And she said to me, you're going to write a book and you're going to speak to thousands. And up until that point, I'd been really impressed with her because she got the details so accurate. And there were details that I hadn't yet shared in my therapy sessions that I was having. And I thought it actually shocked me that someone could dive into my head and retrieve those memories. But it was also very comforting in a way that, yes, I wasn't going mad, that these details were true. But when she said, you're going to speak to thousands, I see you on a stage, you're going to write a book, I thought, oh, now what a load of rubbish. She was doing so good up until that moment. And then you went and supported it with all this nonsense. I don't even have an English O-level. How could I write a book? But yeah, she had to apologise to her many years later because she was right. And if you told my younger self that was going to happen, I could never have believed that would be a possibility.
Amazing. That's it. That's very interesting because sometimes when people think about speaking out, particularly if someone is not in the habit of doing that or they find it a scary idea, I think often people imagine that you can just go from zero to suddenly speaking out. And, you know, from your story, it clearly you did an awful lot of personal work along the way, including being open enough to investigate alternative approaches and consider that. So that must have, your description of how you responded to that, the woman who wrote the book, and the experience you had when you were writing, to me, that sounds like quite a sophisticated embracing of going with the flow. That's not something that somebody can often do without any practice or without having done any personal work along the way.
Yeah, no, it's definitely, I did not get to this place overnight. This is literally decades of therapy, of talking therapy, and as you say, kind of alternative therapies. And I kind of went down that road because I struggled with my memories when they returned. I couldn't believe them. I didn't want to believe them. I thought it said something about me. And I just thought, you know, I worked for many, many years in women's aid and at rape crisis. I was a volunteer. And I just thought, well, I've just taken on other people's memories, other people's stories. It's not really anything about me. Now looking back, it was total denial, and I was just minimizing what had happened, because why would you want to remember, you know, your darkest chapters of your life? So my therapist suggested I should try some, I think I started with therapeutic massage, and just the very first time, the way I responded, I was just kicking and fighting and crying and shouting, and I was mortified. I was so embarrassed, but in some ways it really helped my mind, because I thought, can't really trust my mind. I mean, you know, if, what is our mind? If I cut it in half, it doesn't bleed or doesn't do anything, but it was giving me all this information. But I thought I had to trust my body. There's no way I would make it respond that way, because, you know, I was reserved to make a fuss or a noise. And when I saw how it shook and how it cried, and just by unleashing the trauma trapped in my cells, it actually was very comforting in a strange, if that makes any sense at all. But it really reassured me that there is something in there. This didn't come from my imagination, that actually the way I responded was really response to trauma that was in there already. So that helped me. And then that led me onto a path of just trying other things to really connect back to my body, I guess, and to land back in my body, because I escaped it when I was 13. I left, and I took me a long, long time to get back into my body, really.
Yeah. Well, thank God you were able to escape it. I think it's one of the wonderful survival faculties that we have, isn't it? That sometimes it's like, sorry, I'm out of here. You know, this is too much. Yeah. And then sometimes we can come back and sometimes we can't.
Yeah, so it is a paradox, really, because I do believe if I stayed in at that time at 13, I wouldn't be here. I think I would have died or whatever. But so I left, which is a great, you know, supportive technique that we do under extreme cases of trauma or just, you know, whatever's happening. But then later on, when the memories returned, it felt very dreamlike because I was out at the time. So it was very surreal. So it helped, and then it didn't help. So it's a battle with the mind, really, to accept what's fiction and what's fact. So, yeah, but I don't think I'd be here if I hadn't got out of the way of what was taking place.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thank God you did, you know, because thank you, you know, since you did that. And by the way, I just want to say how impressed I am with how you've done this entire journey. And I'm sure I'm not the first person to say that, because, you know, you've had a lot of response. And then you took that and started working with other people. Tell me a bit about that transition, how that started to happen.
A lot of people think I became a therapist because of my own story. Actually, it was really because of my dad's story. So my dad was a Holocaust survivor who lost all of his family apart from his sister. He had one brother who left before the Nazis invaded former Czechoslovakia, but sadly that brother died of a heart attack despite not going through the camps. So my aunt survived the whole of Auschwitz. My dad was in a labor camp. And I was just fascinated as a child. If you met my dad, he loved life. He mucked about. He laughed a lot. He, you know, life was for living. If you met my auntie Eva, she was chronic schizophrenic, agoraphobic, directly as a result of her experiences in Auschwitz. And I was just always intrigued. How could two people go through a very, very similar situation but come out so differently? And that always, you know, played on my mind. So, for example, in a different circumstances, I could have two clients that maybe both are grieving their father. And one would say, I'll never get over the death of my dad. I'm always going to grieve. And one would say, I'm just so grateful that he was my dad and I'm so happy to have been his daughter. So that just always fascinated me. But ironically, even though I worked at Rape Crisis and Women's Aid, I then went on to train to become a counsellor and a psychotherapist. I was a magnet for abuse and rape, not just because of my story, but I think there's so much out there that I didn't specialise in it, but most of my clients came with that history. Somehow they were just gravitated towards me without even knowing my story behind what was behind the therapist they were sitting with. But latterly, before I stopped working, most of my clients came from a place of abuse.
Yeah. And what did you find, what did you find that they needed from you mostly?
Well, it was never spoken. It was always unspoken, but I always took hope into my sessions. I always know from watching my dad, really, he was my greatest teacher. If we choose to, with the right support, we really can get past anything that's happened to us. Because, again, our mind, you know, when we're so caught and we're so triggered, it takes us back as if we're there. But if you can really work those pictures, because they are just pictures and responses, it's not happening anymore. You know, it is done, but we have to kind of dive into the fear and the shame and the painful pictures to dilute them and eventually just allow them just to be, you know, just not to stir them up anymore. So I just always took in hope, but that I was steady and I could really listen to anything without flinching. Because I know for my own self, when I was going for therapy, as a client, I've sat in both chairs many times. You know, I could look in the therapist's eyes and thought, nah, you're not going to be able to listen to what I've got to say. Just something just in my gut. And I think clients that I worked with would be the same. They would know whether you were capable or not. The ones that come back or don't, they get a sense. So just to really, it was a great job because it's the only thing I know that connected me in. I had to be totally 100% present. I had to meet them. It was also their job to meet me. Sometimes, obviously, it was nothing to do with me. They weren't able to meet me. But, yeah, it was. I did love it. I really did. So it was a job that really kept me very present if I had to really be there for someone. So, yeah, I always brought in hope and just the thought that, you know, you can do this and you've got this. You might not think it now, but you will get there.
Beautiful. I know exactly what you mean about looking at, if you're the client and you look at the therapist and think they can't hear this. I had a bizarre situation once where after my divorce, which was not traumatic at all, I mean, distressing, but not, I rang up the local, what's that charity that helps people with marital problems?
Was called Relate, but I think
that's it.
A different name now. I think they've changed the name.
I rang them up a year later and I said, I just want to make sure I've processed this ending of this relationship as well as I possibly can. Can I come in and have a session with somebody? And they just were completely confused. No, they'd never had this request ever before. So I went in and sat down and she started asking my story and asking all about my family. Now, in my family, it so happens that a lot of people have died a lot younger than we might hope. Okay. Right. And I told her all of this. And by the end of it, she was traumatized. she couldn't cope with the fact that all these, and she couldn't cope with the fact that I seemed okay. You know, it was very distressing for her. And she said, I'm sorry, I just can't.
And I don't know, I might be doing them a disservice. Are they volunteers or are they therapeutically trained?
I don't know. I think she was trained. But I don't know what the degree of the training was. You know, it could have been like an in-house sort of course thing. But that experience of looking at the other person and thinking, this person doesn't actually have the capacity to contain or to hold this particular aspect. You know, so I can imagine with you, I mean, as you're talking, I'm thinking, wow, it'd be almost worth having a trauma to come to you. Maybe not.
Looking back now, you know, I used to think maybe they didn't have the capacity, but maybe I was doing them a disservice because also I was still so traumatized that I used to think if I told anyone, it would distress them too much. So that was another way of my shame telling me, don't tell anyone. And also I was worried that if I did start to tell them, somehow it would get back to these boys and they would come and find me. So that was still my fear, running the show a lot with me. So a lot of it, you know, wasn't just the therapist was no good. It was also what was going on inside my head. So, you know, there are good therapists out there. But in the end, I got to a place where I wanted to challenge my fears, because I saw my fears really, they ran my show. They were my best friend for many years and halted me, you know, kept me back for years because I listened to them far too long. But I saw a lot of them were really, they were just my imagination, because they were all based on what had already happened to me, and then they were based on what could happen. And when I saw that, I thought, they're not real. They're really not real. It's just a story I've been telling myself for years to protect myself. But actually, you know, the worst things already happened. I don't need protecting anymore. So then I was in a place of challenging myself. So I went to see an American male therapist, and these two young men were both male, obviously, and both American. So somehow that was my way of testing myself. But actually, he was the first person that I ever told the whole of the story to in its entirety. And he then encouraged me to tell my husband, who knew of it but didn't know all the details. So I am eternally grateful that he was able to hold what I had to say. It was only one moment where I saw he flinched, but that was it in all the 3 years. So there will always be someone out there, but sometimes it is a bit of a trial and error just finding the right person. Sometimes I've thought, I think you need more therapy than me. That was maybe me just not really wanting to connect with it and just found an excuse not to go along with it. But I did find someone that was very capable of listening to what I had to say.
Amazing. That thing you were saying about imagining that if all the reasons in our head that tell us not to speak about it, and have you, what sort of understanding do you have now around understanding that resistance, that unwillingness to speak out? Is there some sort of survival benefit to that? You know, where does that come from, do you think?
I think when we get our memories, we just want to push them as far away, you know, we literally depress them, we push them as far away and we minimize it and we say it wasn't that bad. And it's avoidance, isn't it, really? Why would you want to, you know, visit the most painful chapters? Why would you want to reread them and reread them? Because that's what I really had to do. I kind of think of it like a multi screen cinema center, and for years, even though I didn't want to go speak about it or talk about it, I was watching the same movie over and over again, and that affected everything that I did because the story was always running in my head. So I would always come from a very fearful place. So, you know, I had to trust the person I was telling my story with. If I didn't feel like I could trust them, that was it. Well, what's the point of telling you? I can't trust them, and what are they going to do with it? But then I finally saw. Eventually it got to a place where the denial of it and the refusing to believe it was actually causing me more harm than the pictures themselves. That was wearing me out emotionally, physically. It was actually driving me crazy, to be honest. Pressure, as I speak about holding it in, was actually really hurting my mind and affecting everything I did. Holding everything in, the pressure was just too much. So I thought, well, I've got nothing to lose now. You know, I may as well go and, I mean, I actually originally went to therapy to get him to take the memories away. So I wasn't a very good client. I wanted a lobotomy. Can I just cut this bit out and just, you know, get rid of it? And I realized quite quickly on, actually, the only way to get rid of it or to make it less powerful or to make it less prominent was to go in. So the way in is always the way out. That's what I learned quite quickly on.
Yeah. So how can somebody recognize that they are in that avoidance? Are there some sort of telltale signs that someone's...
That's a very tricky question because you're so caught up with avoiding it. But, you know, so... when I look back now, it's hard when you're in it to really see it. It's so much easier when you're out. But when I look back now, even though I didn't know I was denying and in avoidance, the fear, you know, if I got into my car, I pressed the buttons down. If Stephen was away, my husband, I wouldn't take my wheelie bin down the end of my garden to put it out because it was dark. You know, I could only do it in the daytime, fear of somebody jumping out at me. Or if I went to a multi-story car park, I couldn't go up more than a few flights because I couldn't take the lift in case somebody came in and they attacked me. If I walked down the street, always had my keys in my hand. If there was a man, I'd cross the road. So these little things just dictated my life. You know, they affected me, everything. I thought about, if I didn't think about, I wasn't thinking about what happened, but I was thinking about my safety all the time. And I was thinking about men and not being out of control, trying to control everything, which I think is just a way of avoiding. I think when I started to develop a little bit of OCD, you know, everything had to be in its place. Everything had to be, before I left the house, the kitchen had to be tidy, the beds had to be made, and the washing basket had to be empty. It was a way of controlling those things, as was a way of not connecting with those other things. So I think if you start to see that happening, these, you know, some people might say they're healthy, but they were very unhealthy patterns because they then took up too much space in my mind. So I was obviously trying to push that out and push something else in, but it was always there. It's like a room in your house that, or a cupboard that you open the door and just shove something in and then shut the door. So I was doing that more and more and just filling the other rooms with, I'm fine, I'm in control, I'm tidying, I'm cleaning, my washing's out and everything's okay. But that was a bit manic, really. So I think if you see your behavior just, you know, magnifying things that you don't feel are too healthy that are actually causing you distress, then I think that's the time to go, hang on, what am I doing here? What's really going on? What's behind this all?
I can certainly resonate with that. I mean, I've never experienced anything like you have, but I've certainly had times when there's something that's really bothering me and I don't want to think about it, or I want to avoid it, or there's something I need to see about myself, a blind spot that's trying to come out into the light, you know, and that I'll avoid it by being, you know, over-organized, as you're saying. And that's that fear that you mentioned. I think that's a very potent red flag, isn't it? You know, if there's a kind of disproportionate fear going on that doesn't seem to really relate directly to what's actually happening in the life right now, what's that about? You know, what's that to do with?
So I guess the whole journey really is about growing your awareness and becoming aware of, you know, what are you doing? Is this helping me or not helping me? Is this healthy or not healthy? So it got to the point where I was able to question it. You know, I know when I'm getting flustered, I can feel myself getting wound up and think, whoa, okay, I start racing around, you know, zipping around my house much faster than normal. And I think, okay, I need to just take a step back, ground myself again, you know, focus in. So, yeah, it's, even though I might appear calm now, I still get flustered and still have days, moments, you know, where it's like, oh, this is getting a bit much. I need to just really take some time out now.
I think we all do, Madeline, if we're honest about it. Well, because life in itself, you know, has difficult moments, just naturally. So you were saying earlier that you no longer do the psychotherapy work. So what are you doing now?
Well, about 2.5 years ago, before the start of COVID, I was being asked to speak more and more as a speaker. So once I went public, I was invited to speak. And I've never really looked for speaking events. They've kind of luckily come to me. Normally somebody will hear me and then they'll invite me to speak. So that's really how I've worked. And then I just thought to myself, you know, I'm juggling being a therapist and I'm juggling speaking, and I was getting asked to speak more and more, and I thought maybe I should just focus on speaking out, because in therapy it was great. I loved witnessing the journey, the transformation of my clients, but it was on a one-to-one and it's a lot slower. And I thought, you know, if I spoke, I could help many rather than one-to-one. It'd be one-to-many. And I thought, you know, I like signs, and I thought, okay, I'd need a sign. This was kind of near the end of a year. And I thought, if I'm going to speak, I'd love to speak globally. And I thought that would be brilliant. You know, that would mean I'm a real speaker if I could be international. I don't know why. And so I set this thought in my head. I sent it out there to the world. And I woke up on New Year's Day. A friend of mine Skyped, who I'd met at a speakers conference from Johannesburg, and he invited me to come speak at their conference in Joburg, which I did. And I thought, okay, it's not a bad sign. And then about 5 days later, I was contacted by someone that was setting up a conference in the Maldives on behalf of UNICEF as one of their ambassadors. And they invited me to speak. And I thought, okay, thank you, life. These are two very good signs. So I slowly ended all my sessions with my clients, and I started to speak globally as well as in the UK. And just before lockdown, my first ever closing speaking, you know, came to me. I was speaking in Namibia and it was a big speakers conference and they invited me to be the closer. So most people like to be the opener or the closer. They're kind of like the two biggest ones. And I thought, yeah, great. My career's just taken off. Brilliant. I mean, we got to the airport, you know, they were taking our temperatures and I thought, oh, they're making a big fuss about this, you know, this COVID thing that we've heard. And then literally 3 weeks later, the UK went into lockdown and I thought, oh, all my, you know, diary appointments just one by one cancelled, evaporated, disappeared, and then it was blank. And I thought, well, I don't really want to go back to being a therapist. I thought it's going to blow over, you know, I was a bit naive, and I'll just go back to speaking in person in a few weeks, and obviously a few weeks and a few months, and then and now it's been a couple of years. So I started to do some speaking online, and I have a few more in-person events coming up. So that's kind of really how it happened. And I did think about going back to be a therapist, but I really like working with people that are thriving, and that's no offense taken, hopefully, to anyone that's struggling. But I think because I've done the journey so much, I don't know, I just felt like I don't think I could go back to working with people that are in trauma right now. It just didn't sit right with me. So I still want to pursue speaking out, and I still think I can help more if I speak out to groups rather than one-to-one. So
yeah,
it's kind of what it is at the moment.
Yeah, beautiful. And I also think that aspect around service, that sometimes we're called to serve in one way and sometimes we're called to serve in another. And just because there's something that we do very well or that we can do doesn't mean that we have to in that moment. So I completely resonate to that, having had various sort of shifts in my what I do. And I've had people say, yes, but these people over here need that. And I, well, that's not what I'm called to do right now.
That's a good reminder. Thank you.
Well, no, thank you. You reminded me, actually. You reminded me first. So this is great. I'm so appreciating this conversation, Madeline. I'm just going to shift the emphasis very slightly. You know, if we think now about, you mentioned the last couple of years, and that obviously affected your diary and everything else. It affected all our lives in many ways. And there are a lot of problems now in the world. And, you know, economies are in a bit of a state, and there's wars going on. There's all sorts of things going on. And my electricity bill the other day, I do not even want to talk about that. You know, there all these things happening. And there are a lot of people in leadership positions, whether it's political leaders, corporate leaders, community leaders, spiritual leaders, who are clearly, I would hope, wanting to try to improve things. What do you think you'd love to have those people thinking about or exploring? If you kind of look into what you've learned over the years, what would you like to offer to those people for them to help them with what they're trying to do now?
So it's what would I like the leaders to know to help other people?
Yeah, to help us, to help the collective and be the best leader they can be. Because you now embody an extraordinary body of wisdom as a result of your experience and all the personal work you've done and all that work you've done with clients and all the speaking that you're doing. So you've got that in your mind and in your heart and in your body, you know, and you are serving in the way you are called to serve right now. And you can see the world, you have your perception of the world, and you know there are all these other people out there wanting to serve, wanting to be helpful. What wisdom would you offer them?
Yeah, it's a good thing.
To help them.
And a very big question, really, isn't it? Well, I think for me in lockdown, what I learned, you know, we were chatting before about pets making a noise, a doorbell ringing while we're recording, and lockdown, when I was doing my podcast, it taught me to be human rather than to be perfect. And I think people really respect honesty. You know, if we are going to struggle, let's be honest, don't lie. We've seen that people don't like, you know, politicians that lie and tell us one thing and they're really doing another thing. I think just to be a better human being, just to connect in and to feel supported, that's always what people want, whatever's going on. To me, those are my values. Those are what's important to me. So I'm sure they must resonate with other people as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And from your experience working with people and speaking out and writing your book, what do you feel are some of the things that you've learned that are helpful to help people to be honest, to help people to speak?
It's interesting because when I talk about being honest, I wasn't going to be honest to start with. So I worked, I guess you would call him a shaman, for many, many years. I still do, a man named Imaho. And he encouraged me to write my story down. And I said, there's no way, no way am I ever going to write that down. No way you'll ever read it. And I'm never going to speak about it. But he, you know, encouraged me. And literally 4 years it took to write 12 pages. And then I emailed at him and he asked me if he could use it at one of his workshops. He wanted to show people that despite, you know, whatever we go through, we can literally walk through the fire and come out the other side and even get to a place of forgiveness. And I was like, oh, it's one thing you reading it, but then to share it with all these people, I was like, I don't think I could do that. And he asked me to be very explicit, to write down all the details, you know, don't hold anything back. So I did, but it took years and years. So he did use it at a workshop, and the impact was huge for me because I felt very exposed, but it was like shedding my outer tough skin, you know. It was like a snake. I felt, even though I felt so exposed and vulnerable, it was actually very good because I saw what sharing and being vulnerable did, not just for me, but then for other people. And then people would, you know, even though they were told not to come and bother me and speak to me about it, people couldn't help themselves. So they would tell me over the 4 days of a workshop what it did to them, or share their own stories, or how they were going to use it. So that was one thing. Then when I went to write the book, my friend Joe was my editor, who also goes to Imaho's workshops. And he said to me, you are going to include all those details that you wrote for him. I said, no, Joe, there's no way. That's, you know, I just wrote everything, what they did to me. And he said, no, you have to. And I said, I don't think I could. But he said, as a man, it just really made him think, you know, when he thought about rape and a woman, he just thought you were just a bit, you know, taken over, you know, just a bit forced. And that was it. He didn't appreciate the levels of violence that could take place because it was near fatal what they did to me. And he said, it's very important to expose that dark truth, to, you know, to bring it forward. So he did a number on me and he worked me. And then I thought, you know, I shouldn't really sugarcoat this. I shouldn't make it easy for people to digest. We should be uncomfortable because this, my story is just a story of many, many people, of many women and men. Somewhere on this planet will know exactly what I'm speaking about. It takes place every day. And then I thought, yeah, he's right. I should really share all the details. And so when I eventually got my publisher, they said to me, listen, they don't think they can write all those details down. I said, no, I won't publish the book otherwise. I said, I'm not going to write it and not be truthful, because if I'm going to say it, I'm just going to say it once. And so they decided that chapter, they agreed with me in the end, and that chapter should have a trigger warning, which I'm not so convinced about, because I think, well, I didn't have a trigger warning when I was 13. And I think if you pick up a memoir of a woman who's been gang raped, you kind of know it's going to be about rape. You know, there is a clue in the blurb on the book or the title. So, yeah, I had to go through this whole honesty journey, even though I'm saying I want people to be honest. And I could see that was really just my shame. That was just layers of shame that I still had to work through and work through and work through till I really thought and saw what was done to me isn't a reflection of me. You know, I'm not the things that they did. Yes, they tried to degrade me and dehumanize me, but I think the core that we're all born with, that light, that goodness, that hara, that fire, whatever you want to call it, they can't ever touch that. So if that's the same for me, that's the same for everyone. So I think I wanted to show the darkness and the light, that yes, I went through horrible experience. My experience is just one that many, many people will, but you can walk through it. So yeah, so that's a very long answer to your question.
Well, it was a big question. So this is why these episodes are not 20 minutes long, because you know, it's great to go into a little bit more depth, because then people can actually get a sense of, just a little sense of what you've learned over many decades. We can pick up a little bit of that. And I think that's one of the reasons I love the podcasting medium, and you must find it too in your episodes, that it's an opportunity for people to share something in a different way. And it's an opportunity for people to take it in, listen to it and reflect on it in their own time. And it's something I've really heard in what you just said, is that being honest is a great service to people, and that sometimes you have to go on a journey to get to the point where you can be fully honest. So for some of these leaders listening to this episode, and I've come across this a lot actually with clients who've said, right, we want to bring in more honesty in our organization. And sometimes they imagine they can just flick a switch and it will just begin. But no, they've got to get to the point where they can be more honest and open and authentic.
Walk the talk and lead by your example.
Mm. And sometimes it takes time to get to the point where you have the capacity to do that. You can't just go put it on your to-do list, now be honest. So it takes time. And that's something I'm really getting from this conversation with you, that the importance of going through a period of growth that takes us to a place where we can then be honest and we can speak out.
So, it is a process. You know, it's no sprint. It's been a marathon, a long, long marathon. It's taken me a long, long time to get to where I'm at.
Yeah. Yeah. Amazing. So we're just sort of starting to come towards running out of time. If someone's been listening to this and they've thought, oh my God, this is really fascinating and I really want to respond to what Madeline's saying, how on earth do I begin? I'm just an ordinary person pottering along in my life, being an ordinary person. What might I do first to help me to be more honest and to help me to help other people be more honest? Where might I begin? What would you say?
I'm assuming you mean someone that's had a similar history to me.
No, just anybody at all, because we've all had things happen in our lives. We've all had things that we're avoiding.
Yeah, well, you have to wake up first to what you're avoiding. It's going to be different for everybody. You have to see what you're avoiding. So I would say just become a really good witness or a detective in your own life first before you can, you know, go to serve anyone else. Because I couldn't stand on a stage or speak, you know, online if I wasn't in a good place. I couldn't, because then you really start to speak from your wound rather than your scar. And my wound could get open and I could infect myself. I could infect my audience. And that wouldn't be therapeutic. That would be, you know, I could traumatize my audience if I wasn't careful with the subject matter I speak about. So you have to do the work is really, I guess. So pay attention, become a detective, become a good witness. You know, recognize when you do things, as we said, that aren't helping. I'm just about to do that thing I always do, run around and empty all the bins, make sure there's no rubbish everywhere, or whatever it is that you do. Is it okay just to leave a little piece of paper in the dustbin? Do I have to empty it? You know, why am I doing things? You know, just dig and dive into, what am I covering up? What am I avoiding? Am I covering up or am I avoiding? You know, is this behavior normal or whatever? Just become a better detective. I think we look at things sometimes when we're not really healed through the perspective of that moment. So it's about changing the lenses all the time. Always change the lenses in your glasses. Like the old-fashioned optician that used to pop them in the side, you know, oh, I just need a different lens. And then slowly it just gets clearer and clearer and clearer. And you think, these are the games I've been playing with myself. We're very good at playing games, you know. We are cat and mouse with ourselves. We don't need anyone else. We just go around in circles. So yeah. Just be aware. Just really be aware of what you do. And only once you cleaned up your own act, then you can really help others to clean up their act.
Beautiful. I love that. Become a better detective in your own life. I love that. Because that's exciting and interesting and fun. Yeah. You know, lovely, beautiful. Thinking back over this whole conversation, has there been a favourite part of our conversation today for you?
Yeah, that's a tricky question because I literally just answer the question as I hear it. And that's no offence to you, but I often don't really remember what I've said before because I just answer it. But yeah, I just love what the person brings because everybody will bring themselves to the interview, but they always bring a question, they frame it in a different way. So every conversation I have is always unique, and that's what I love about all conversations. And I love questions. I really do love questions because I love to see where your mind is going with my story and what your mind is doing with it and how that can then help other people. And sometimes I get feedback and they say, oh, I heard you on this podcast and you said that, and I think, oh, that wasn't my intention when I answered it for you to get that. I was thinking this way. So everybody will take from it wherever they're at. You know, they'll hear, if you ask five people they may all hear a very, very different response to an answer. And that I find fascinating, where our minds take us when we listen.
Beautiful. I love that too. And I find something interesting because, of course, I listen to a podcast after recording it, to edit it. And I also listen to it again after it airs. Mm-hmm. And each time I listen to it, I get something else from it. And I said to a friend the other day, doing this podcast, it's a bit like I get a fresh seminar with someone amazing every week, but I get the seminar three times.
Yeah.
So it's a wonderful thing. Well, it's been absolutely fantastic having you, Madeline. Where would you like people to go if they want to find you?
Oh, you could just go to my website and it has all the social media links. It's madelineblack.co.uk.
Beautiful. Well, thank you so much for coming, and it's been absolute delight. And I think what you're doing is just amazing. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to Truth and Transcendence, the regular weekly podcast from Yes, You Now with Catherine Llewellyn. For more information, head to yesyounow.today/podcast.